Welcome to this Forthright Radio for March 20th, 2019. I'm Joy LaClaire, and we have a very full show for you today in two parts. In about 40 minutes, we'll hear from award-winning environmental journalist Carrie Gillam, author of Whitewash, The Story of a Weed Killer, Cancer, and the Corruption of Science, about the unanimous San Francisco Federal Court jury verdict on March 19th, 2019. Determining that Monsanto's glyphosate-based weed killer Roundup was a, quote, substantial factor, end quote, in former Wallala resident Edwin Hardiman's developing non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. We hope you can stay tuned for that. But now, our first guest is Michael Kaufman, Ph.D. Michael Kaufman is the co-founder of the White Ribbon Campaign, the largest international effort of men working to end violence against women. He has worked across North America and in 50 countries with the United Nations, governments, NGOs, and businesses as an advisor and speaker. He is a senior fellow with ProMundo, based in Washington, D.C. He is the author or editor of 8 books, including Cracking the Armor, Power, Pain, and the Lives of Men, and Beyond Patriarchy, Essays by Men on Pleasure, Power, and Change. His latest book is The Time Has Come, Why Men Must Join the Gender Equality Revolution, published by Counterpoint Press. We welcome you to Forthright Radio, Michael Kaufman.
Great to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you. Michael, you have been working in the field of gender equality and the prevention of violence against women for 4+ decades, and I am happy to report to our listeners that even though it's belied in headlines proclaiming the really awful things men do, your book demonstrates the many examples of men organizing to promote a different, more equitable world, not just for women, but for everyone. I love that you choose to use the term human liberation in addition to gender equality. Would you please briefly recount for our listeners your work and your journey over those decades?
One of the things that we know when you said that the horrible things that men do, the thing is that the majority of men do not do those things. The majority of men don't commit acts of violence and hate and so forth. One of the problems has been that in the past, the majority of us have been silent about those things. And because men still have power in our society, if men are silent about things such as men's violence or women's rights, those problems, those issues, tend to continue. So my book and my work over these years has been really sort of a positive approach to bring men into not just the conversation, but actions to promote women's rights and better lives for us all. One of the things I think is it's more of us are realizing that what I call the gender equality revolution, it's not just about, you know, women gaining and men losing. It is about women obviously benefiting. But I think finding ways that men are really going to benefit, too. One of the big examples of that, Joy, is right now we're seeing across North America, around the world, a real transformation in the role of fathers. You know, I remember when my kids were young, many years ago now, if I couldn't do something on a certain night, people would say, oh, you're babysitting tonight, or great how much you help out with your kids. Now, if anyone said that to, you know, to my son or to other, you know, younger fathers these days, they'd want to bop them on the head. They'd say, I don't help out. I'm a parent. Well, this big change in men's lives, this transformation of fatherhood, which is one of the themes of The Time Has Come, it came about because women have been obviously, you know, pursuing jobs and careers and education. Women have pushed men to do our half of the childcare and housework. And of course, yeah, it is hard work, demanding work, but I think for many men, we realize it's the best thing that ever happened to us. So that's just an example of the positive spirit of my book. This is not about some sort of male sort of collective blame or self-blame or anything like that, but it is really about men speaking out as allies, as friends, as lovers, as husbands, as partners, as brothers, as sons, as workmates for the women in our lives.
You are the co-founder of the White Ribbon Campaign, and we're going to talk about all the wonderful things, but let's get back to what caused you to do that. That was in response to a pretty horrible thing. Would you talk about that, please?
Yeah, I grew up in Ohio and North Carolina, but my parents are Canadian, and we moved back to Canada when I was a teenager. And so I live in Canada, and back in 1991, we had a national tragedy, and that was 14 women were murdered by a man who blamed women on his problems. Now, you know, this type of mass shooting are, to say the least, extremely rare in Canada, and it just galvanized the country, these murders, in 1989. 2 years later, in 1991, three men, were challenged by women to finally do something, and to do something really to mobilize men's voices, you know, to end men's silence. You know, it wasn't just that one action. One of the things that we know is that we still have a persistent problem in our homes with various forms of physical, sexual, emotional, financial abuse of women. We have problems in our workplaces of sexual harassment. And as I was saying a minute ago, the majority of men don't do these things. But because we're silent, other men, I guess, just assume it's okay. So we developed what we called the White Ribbon Campaign. It was back in the days before there were ribbons for everything. And it was a pretty simple idea of men looking at our own attitudes, our behavior, learning to speak out. And this campaign, it spread, I think, to about 80 or 90 countries. It's not huge in the U.S. There's places where there are city or statewide efforts. But it's a grassroots cause. There's no sort of official membership, but it's an idea. It's a vehicle for men to speak out. But you know, some joy. You know, sometimes I'm asked by interviewers when they know I've done among the work I've done is that on ending violence against women, and they assume I've got some terrible secret in my past. You know, their voices will drop down and they'll say, "Tell me what happened." And I'll tell why, gosh, I just had this wonderful childhood with, you know, wonderful dad and mom, and I didn't know these problems existed until I was an adult and started reading about it, hearing from women. But one of the things that really did open my eyes to inequality was actually not around women's rights, but it happened when I was a kid, when I was 9 years old, and we moved from Cleveland to Durham, North Carolina, as you can hear from my heavy southern accent. And we moved, you know, to Durham in the height of racial segregation, the beginning of the civil rights movement. And my parents had a basic rule. They said we wouldn't go to segregated movies or restaurants, which means we didn't go out very much. Now, as a little kid, you just want to be, you know, one of the kids, one of the gang. And I complained to my parents, why can't I go to that movie with my friends? I was a kid in, you know, 9 years old or 10 years old, 11. And they just explained, as long as everyone doesn't have that right, we don't have that right. We don't do that. And so they taught me that you've got to choose sides. And so when the women's movement started in the late 60s and the 70s, the women's rights, the women's liberation movement, and my friends certainly were outspoken in their support, my women friends, I realized as a man, I needed to take sides. I couldn't just be complacent. I couldn't just pay lip service. But I had to think about, well, what that meant for my own choices, for my own life, for my own decisions, for my relationships. And so it's been an interesting journey, shall we say.
We're speaking with Michael Kaufman. His latest book is The Time Has Come: Why Men Must Join the Gender Equality Revolution. Michael, you talk about the paradox of power and how patriarchy isn't so good for most men. Would you dissect that a bit for us?
Yeah, this is one of the things that I just find fascinating. First of all, let's say we've made incredible progress, you know, led by women's organizations, women's movement, just courageous women in our workplaces and homes and neighborhoods. We've seen amazing progress in women's rights over the past number of decades. We still have a number of problems. We still have a ways to go. We're still far from pay equality. We still have a persistent problem of violence against women. We still have a reality where most of our economic, our political leaders, our religious leaders are still men. We still have, you know, a lack of adequate support for mothers, for all parents. The U.S. is the only country in the world, along with Papua New Guinea and Lesotho, these tiny countries, that doesn't have paid parental leave. So we still have a bunch of problems. So if we were to go through a whole list of things and we say, okay, economically, men still on average have it better off in terms of access to certain jobs and on, we could come up with a compelling case that says, yep, in spite of improvements, we still live in a society of inequality. But let's imagine walking out onto a street with a, you know, with a microphone, and, you know, Joy, you could do a, you know, a man on the street, well, they're the man, you're the woman, but on the street interviews, and you'd know all about men's power, and you say, sir, tell me all about your power, and that man would look at you like you're crazy. He'd say, power, me, are you nuts? I don't have power. So how do we understand this gap between the still existing world of inequality of men's power and that individual experience that we men have? Well, I think it's the result of several things, all of which are interesting to us. First of all, when you enjoy some form of privilege, some form of power, one feature that it's invisible to you. You don't see you have it. You just take it for granted. So, you know, me as a guy with white skin, I don't have to think about certain things. I don't have to think about if I'm driving my car at night, whether or not I have to worry if I'm pulled over. Me as a straight guy, I don't have to sort of think twice if I hold hands with my wife or kiss her in public. Similarly, you know, as a man, when I was young, going into a job interview, I wouldn't have to think twice about someone thinking, well, gosh, he's going to become a parent in the next few years, I'm sure, and better not give him the job. In other words, as men, we don't all see the forms of privilege or power we have. That's one reason why that man would say, I don't have power. A second reason is that a male-dominated society is not just the power of men over women. It's also the power of some men over other men. And so there are groups of men who really don't have much power, because of their income, their socioeconomic class, because of the color of their skin, because of their sexual orientation. And so the world of men is a world where there's a lot of men who are, well, the world of all of us, but I'm just here talking about men, is a world where a lot of men are hurting right now, are feeling they can't be the providers they were told to be, and so forth. But there's a third thing, and this is the real paradox. The very ways that we have set up men's lives, the very ways we've defined manhood, actually come with a cost to men ourselves. Let me tell you a story about how early these expectations happen and are placed on who, you know, what men are supposed to be. It's one of the stories I tell in the book, and there's a lot of stories in there, but one is when my son was born. So this is, you know, a number of years ago now. There we are in the delivery room, and my kid had been born like 5 seconds, and I didn't yet know if it was a boy or a girl. You know, not because I'm dumb, but because at this moment I had, you know, so many tears in my eyes, I couldn't see the little thing. And I mean the little thing on the little thing. I didn't know if it was a boy or girl until the nurse spoke. Now, until this moment, she'd been speaking in her high voice, and suddenly her voice dropped down really deep, and she said, "It's a boy. What a strong little fellow." And I was shocked. Not because it was a boy. I'd, you know, taken high school biology. I figured a 50-50 chance on that. But I was shocked by the change in her voice and what she said. And it was like, you know, my kid was 5 seconds old and being fitted for his first football jersey. Now, and this is what happens with boys and then with men. We say to boys, you will always be strong. You will be in control. You won't show any feelings. You won't have too many feelings. You'll never back down. You'll learn to fight. You don't need help. On and on, this list of expectations. You will be the provider. You will have endless sex. Of course, the endless sex would only be with women. It's a pretty long list. And you're supposed to have, you know, totally ripped body, you know, like a Calvin Klein underwear model, which, you know, of course, is my other job. But, you know, this impossible list of expectations. So what happens when we can't live up to that? What happens when we can't live up to these ideals, when we're just a human being who's strong sometimes and other times not, where we have different feelings, where we can be strong one moment and vulnerable the next? What happens is that we feel deep down, even though we know it's nonsense, but deep down there's a feeling that, well, I must not be a real man. I better prove myself. Now, for some men, not all, not most, but they prove it through violence. Violence against women, violence against other men. Some men prove it by the size of their paycheck or their car or how loud they can talk or who they can talk over. But ultimately, we can't prove it because it's this impossible feeling. And so what's the result? Well, the result, sadly, is that men are more likely to be addicted to alcohol and other drugs. Men die younger than women because we don't ask for help. We don't go to the doctor. We don't go get emotional or physical support. Men are more likely to be in jail. Men are more likely to commit suicide. Men are more distant from other men on average and in general than women are from women or from men in general, because we're worried about, well, you know, will my secret be discovered that I'm not a real man? Anyway, this is this incredible paradox. We live in this male-dominated society, but we've created, this very society has created huge problems for men. Where that leads me in the book is a very positive message, and that message is a message of change. It's a message that says that all these issues that women have been raising, that we keep saying all these, you know, women's issues. Well, the truth is, yeah, they are women's issues, but they're also profoundly issues for men. And they're issues for men because we have a role to play in ensuring women's rights, equality, ensuring that the women that we love and care about, and the many women we'll never ever meet or know, enjoy the same rights and possibilities that we have, not just theoretically, but every day in action. But here's what we're discovering, that these changes are good for us as well.
Well, let's go back to the emotions and also the babies, because you spent a good part of the book, The Time Has Come, talking about fatherhood and the role of emotions in human evolution until 8,000 to 10,000 years ago. And the reason we succeeded as a species was because we did have cooperative parenting or cooperative childcare, shall we say.
Yeah.
I was very interested in how you analyzed what we have come to think of as the traditional mother as the primary caregiver for the first 3 years or so, and how that affects boys in particular when they have to start realizing they're male. Would you talk about that, please?
Yeah, humans are biologically one of the species where males have the capacity to be fully active as parents. There's only two parenting jobs that men are not good at. We're really no good at getting pregnant, and we totally suck at breastfeeding. But besides those things, men have equal capacity. We're able to learn to be as good, caring parents as women are. And not all species of animals have that. Some do, some don't. We're lucky we do. But it appears that with the rise of male-dominated societies, you know, probably around 8 or 10,000 years ago, in those societies that did become, as now virtually all have become, male-dominated, men increasingly distanced ourselves from the active parenting jobs. And this was really exaggerated over the past couple hundred years, 100 years really, where men would go off to work. Men would no longer work right around, you know, the home and family, but we were sort of going further and further away. So we developed this big separation in terms of who does what jobs. And then, we grow up with that, we just assume, well, that's how it's always been. We have these cartoon images like the Flintstones where Fred and Barney go off to work. Well, it's obviously not how it was. There wasn't this sort of separation of work and family life until pretty recently. So what we've done is we've exaggerated mothers' biological role in bearing children and breastfeeding, and we've made it into a whole sort of division in who we are as people. Amazing new research is coming out now about men's biological capacity to nurture. It turns out that when we parent, we undergo some of the same type of hormonal changes that women go through. We become more responsive to, you know, a crying baby, more quick to respond. One of the ability that anyone needs to look after a young child is empathy. You know, the ability to feel what someone else feels. And we need that because babies can't talk. Toddlers can't express their emotions well. So we need to be empathetic to look after others. Well, women have developed that capacity on average, not all women, but on average, more than men on average, because women from generation to generation have learned those nurturing, caregiving skills, either emulating their mother or playing with dolls and so forth. So what do we lose if boys and men aren't developing or even suppressing some of those skills? Well, the result is, first of all, that men's natural capacity to be caregivers isn't as developed as it could be. The other thing that happens is that some men are able to act in very violent ways. Some women too, but more men use more extreme forms of violence than women. And the reason is, if we have lowered empathy, we don't feel the pain we're causing. So one of the things that is so important, and one of the themes of the book, is as men reconnect with that part of ourselves that values, that prioritizes parenting, that says this is an absolute fundamental key part of my life, whether I'm actually parenting my own child or grandparenting or caregiving through as a volunteer or as a teacher, whatever it might be, but prioritizing that part, what happens is that men really develop our emotional abilities. Because, as I say, to parent, you need to plug into other people's feelings and needs and emotions. I remember last year I was giving a talk in Singapore, and it was to these bankers, and it was a lot of the bankers were European expats living in Asia, and one guy was this very senior British banker, like top of his company, and he said that his routine every day was that he would make his kids breakfast, he would then take them to school, he would get to work, he'd say around 9 o'clock, which definitely was not banker's hours. And then he said this was not only important for his wife and her pursuing her career. He said it was not only good for his kids and good for him, but then he said it's made me a better leader. He said I'm a better listener to what my staff is saying. I'm more responsive to different needs. And so it was a really interesting example of how something that you could say ultimately he was pushed into by feminism and women's rights has made him a happier, better, not just man abstractly, but made him a better leader. We're seeing these amazing rapid changes, but it's based on biology. This idea that we're somehow opposites, males and females, there's no science behind it. Our chromosomes are 98.6% the same. We have the same basic genetic makeup. Our brains at birth are almost identical. But what happens is our brains undergo changes as we learn to fit into the stereotypes and ideals of being men and women. Our brains become gendered.
We're speaking with Michael Kaufman. His latest book is The Time Has Come, Why Men Must Join the Gender Equality Revolution. You are a fellow with an international organization called Promundo, and it seems that the work that they do is to work with men and boys to raise boys in a healthier way. Could you talk about that, please?
One of the things that more and more of us are becoming aware of is that the ideals of manhood that we basically humiliate and pressure boys to get into. I mean, think of the little boy who falls down and cries. We make fun of him. You know, big boys don't cry. Don't be a baby. Man up. And so we really humiliate boys and then men into being real men. And it's not a healthy thing. It's not a healthy thing. It's not a functional thing. And so a lot of parents, and one of the reasons why these days, even though Father's Day is still a few months away, I've been asked more and more about the themes in my book around fatherhood, is that more and more women and men are really thinking hard about, okay, how can we raise our sons in ways that are going to help them be independent in the world, to be strong, but to be truly strong in the sense of an internal strength, not just like this show display strength, not just being able to act a certain way or fight or to not complain and play through pain and all that stuff, but to have that genuine inner strength that I think is part of being an authentic and strong human being. And so Promundo, the NGO, the non-government organization that I work with, does research, helps organizations, companies, governments in different countries develop programming that some of it's aimed at young men on issues around consent in relationships, on healthy ideals of masculinity. Some of our programs help parents in the big challenges of raising boys and girls, and some work on issues around men's health. So there's a whole range of different programs. But the idea is, when we talk about the gender equality revolution, you know, we just assume, oh, this is women's stuff or women's revolution. But what our work is really dedicated to in the book is to saying this is an exciting moment for men as well, for boys as well. So we've really got to think about and think hard about some of the ways that we traditionally did things. And we just assume, well, that's the way you did it. That's what men did. That's what parents did in relation to boys. And a lot of us are starting to rethink it, and we want healthier lives for our boys. We want our sons to be successful in this rapidly changing world. I think there's a lot of boys these days who are feeling adrift, who are feeling that the ways that they're being brought up are out of sync with the changing world around them. And so we're seeing that. We're seeing the outcome that, you know, there's many boys that aren't doing as well as the generation before them in school. The boys are unsure about some important, as they get older into young men, they're still unsure about some key issues around consent in relationship, around respect. This is why, as I say, my book is a very positive one about men and boys. But we do have to think hard and really push ourselves to find, I think, better and healthier, more affirmative ways to raise our boys to be men.
You had an interesting take on the word homophobia that I had not thought of before. You point out that the Latin root homo means man, and the Greek root homo means the same, and usually homosexual means affection for the same gender. Mm-hmm. But you point out that homophobia could also be a fear of other men, bi men. I hadn't thought of that before. Do you want to say anything more about that?
Yeah, it's a strange thing. You know, when you think of why is among some men there's this really virulent, quite virulent homophobia, and, you know, we have these cases that just keep coming out of some of the most virulent displays of homophobia, it turns out can be, in some cases, obviously not all, but a man who's ashamed of that part of himself. I'm certainly not saying that's true in all cases by any means. But, yeah, sure, homophobia definitely is fear or hatred of someone because of their sexual orientation. That's true. But I think that deep down, and I say deep down, because I think most men enjoy being with the other guys, but I think there's also some deep fear that men carry around, hidden fear often, of other men. And what is that fear? Well, I think most men you talk to can remember the name of the boy in grade school or junior high or high school who he may have beat him up or he had a fight with or humiliated him. Boys have these deep foundation experiences of, as I was saying, of not living up to the ideals of manhood. And so I think that there's this need that men have to prove that we're one of the guys, we're a real man. When you see men getting together in social settings or work settings, there's a lot of self-deprecating humor and deprecating, men putting down each other, men putting down themselves. And I think it's a bit of a ritual. It's a bit of a ritual display to sort of, when it's self-deprecating, to sort of ward off criticisms from other men. And what are the criticisms about? Well, it's the worry is that you're going to be discovered, that you aren't as tough as you're pretending, or aren't as fearless, or you're not the real man, quote unquote, that you're pretending to be. That of course, as a human being, you have vulnerabilities, you have weaknesses, you have fears. Things may not be as wonderful in your marriage as you're letting on. That you have health fears, whatever it may be. And I think there's real fear of being discovered by other men. Now, this is a bizarre thing because, you know, I say this to women. They say, gosh, you've developed this whole society of male bonding, whether in the locker room or the halls of government or the boardroom where men define the rules. And I say, yes, exactly. We've defined the rules not only to be in control, but to feel safe with one another. So this is another paradox where fear creeps into the lives of men, which is why when I think about feminism, it's actually a movement of liberation, not just for women, but I think for men as well. One of the things I say in the book, which I think has surprised many people, is that I actually think that feminism is one of the greatest gifts that men have ever had. Sometimes I hear someone saying, the problem with feminists, they're a bunch of male haters. And I don't buy it. When you think of it, feminism is a movement that believes that we can live in a world without any violence against women. Well, if you didn't believe in the innate goodness of men, you'd never say that. Feminism believes in families, strong families based on equality, on respect. Well, if you didn't have huge faith in the goodness of men, you would never believe that. You would never say that. So So I actually think that, feminism is a profoundly pro-male movement and set of beliefs that I think in different ways welcomes men into the conversation.
You point out that in male-dominated societies, which, let's face it, at this point is pretty much all of them, there are three attributes at least. There's male domination over women, there's male domination by some men over other men, and there is human domination of nature. We only have a few minutes, but let's talk about that. And I want to point out that numerous studies have been done in the United States indicating that when asked, people, men and women, say that environmentalism is a feminine trait and that that's not a good thing somehow. So anyway, would you talk about those issues?
This is, in a way, one of the most troubling things, because what we're now discovering is that the pursuit of control over nature is having dire consequences, and it's only going to get worse in the life of our children and grandchildren. I mean, not only human-created climate change, which is, we're seeing the increasing volatility of climate and weather and extreme weather incidents, but we're also seeing the destruction of the oceans and the plastics everywhere, and I mean literally everywhere, chemicals dumped into not just the environment but our bodies, which are wreaking havoc. When male-dominated society started probably 8 or 10,000 years ago, it was also at a moment of human history that we moved from just being hunters and gatherers, foragers, to humans that decided, well, we're pretty smart, and we should be able to control the environment around us. And that has allowed, the positive side, that's allowed us to develop as a species, to flourish, to live longer, in the case of medicine, live as a whole, healthier. So I'm not, don't get me wrong, I'm not advocating that we go back to the Stone Age, paleo diets, or whatever, besides the fact. But the problem is that the very ways that we've said we can dominate nature, and that emerged as part of this image of men dominating women, men dominating other men, humans dominating nature. What we find out is in the long run, it doesn't work. Just as people don't want to be controlled and dominated, nature doesn't have that volition, but nature, you can't control and dominate it. In the end, it's going to bite back, and when it bites back, the result is increasingly frightening. And it's a pretty sad commentary that people see it as a concern, as a, quote, soft concern or being weak. People assume we can just somehow get a techno fix out of it. It's not going to happen. Some of the technologies are, first of all, the source of the problem. And this idea that as men we can just control, ultimately keeps backfiring. And I think that's one of the things. And, you know, and some of the first to discover this, of course, indigenous peoples have been saying this for years. Farmers that I talk to increasingly are saying, particularly if I talk to an older farmer, I talked to one recently who says, God, I don't even eat pork anymore because it doesn't taste like real pork. This one farmer just said he became addicted to certain farming practices that have left him in debt, that because of climate change are creating greater insecurity. He's worried about, he's seen farmers around him develop cancers that he believes come from the use of certain pesticides and herbicides. So we have all these things that seem good, but it's either the overuse or misuse of different products and approaches that is leading to some real problems. So it's not to get rid of them. You know, no one's going to say, let's get rid of antibiotics, but boy, we better figure out how we're using and misusing things.
Yeah, it's back to the paradox of power in different ways. We only have a few minutes left, Michael Kaufman, and I probably shouldn't open up this big topic, but it's something that I'm very curious about. You have written about patriarchy. What do you think is the reason that it arose and took over the entire globe? Because for all the reasons you mention in your book, it really doesn't make sense for the human family.
Well, there's a big discussions and debates about, you know, why it arose. There's many who believe it's linked to the fact that as humans began to settle down, they began to compete for territory. Men began to assume the role of fighters and warriors even, and would take over more territory. And the patriarchy became a way for men to basically to control women's reproduction. It was a way to know who your offspring were. And anyways, there's a lot of theories there, but I think what's most interesting is, although the theories are interesting, but is to say the thing about societies, once we develop certain patterns, certain traditions, certain ways of doing things, it becomes the norm, it becomes the habit, it becomes just what we assume is natural, it just feels right. So things that were human-created, we just assume it must be biological, even though there are certainly other human possibilities. And that's the exciting thing about the gender equality revolution that we're now living in, that you and I are living at this moment where thousands of years of how we did business, essentially, is being swept away in the course of one, two, three generations. Now, that makes it in some ways a difficult moment, a challenging moment, because our old certainties and just habits and what, you know, we've taken into our developing brains when we're young about how to act as women and men, all that stuff is getting tossed aside. So it is a difficult time. I think we have to accept that this is difficult. Redefining how we do relationships, how we act at work, who we hire, it is difficult stuff, but it's also an exciting moment. This is a moment that our great-great-great-great-grandchildren are going to be reading about in their history books. This is it, the gender equality revolution. And that's why I say the time has come for men to say to women, we're at your side, I'm at your side, I'm going to figure out what I need to do in my life. And I think for many women who are reading The Time Has Come, they're saying, okay, I want to figure out how to reach the men around me, whether that man is my husband or son or brother or my boss or the person I supervise at work. We've got to figure it together. We've got to, you know, use our smarts at this moment of history. But this is it. We're making history. And for me, that's, yes, it's challenging, but it's also this amazing, exciting moment that you and I can be part of. We can make history together.
Well, that is a great way to end a really wonderful interview. Michael Kaufman, thank you so much for joining us today on Forthright Radio and for your decades of work, which is it's bearing pretty good fruit, I think, even though we may not hear about it very often in the headlines. And I really hope that your latest book, The Time Has Come, Why Men Must Join the Gender Equality Revolution, published by Counterpoint Press, reaches a wide audience. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much to you, Joy. I appreciate it.
And now an update to the ongoing legal challenges to Monsanto, which fits into what Michael Kaufman was just saying. Monsanto, of course, is now a subsidiary of the Bayer Corporation. Yesterday, March 19th, 2019, a jury verdict in the San Francisco Federal Court found that Monsanto's glyphosate-based weed killer Roundup was a, quote, substantial factor, end quote, in causing former Mendocino County resident Edwin Hardeman's non-Hodgkin lymphoma. Edwin Hardeman began using Roundup in 1986 for 3 years to eradicate poison oak and other weeds on his property in Wallala, and then he continued using it for 25 more years after moving to Santa Rosa. Well, we reached award-winning journalist Carrie Gillum earlier this morning to ask her about this. Carrie Gillum's book, Whitewash, The Story of a Weed Killer, Cancer, and the Corruption of Science, has won numerous awards since it came out in 2017. And now let's hear from Carrie Gillum. Carrie Gillum, welcome back to Forthright Radio, and thank you so much for joining us again.
Sure, thank you for having me.
Okay, big news in San Francisco Federal Court yesterday with a former Mendocino County resident, Edwin Hardeman, who lived in Wallala in 1986 to, I guess, 1989, where he began using Monsanto's glyphosate-based Roundup. What happened yesterday and what was his story?
Yeah, I mean, yesterday was a really big day. The jury came back. The judge had bifurcated this trial into two phases, separated it into a phase one and a phase two. So phase one was limited only to evidence about causation. Does Roundup cause cancer? Can it cause cancer? And did it cause cancer in this individual, Edwin Hardeman? That's by itself is a very big question, obviously, and a very difficult one for jurors if they don't have the context and they don't also have the evidence that Monsanto has worked to hide scientific evidence of the dangers of Roundup. So the plaintiffs put on their best scientific evidence, and the defense, Monsanto and Bayer's attorneys, put on their best scientific evidence. And the jurors deliberated for, gosh, it was about a week, but they came back yesterday and said unanimously that they did find that the scientific evidence was in the plaintiff's favor, and that Roundup was a substantial factor in causing his non-Hodgkin lymphoma.
Now, is that wording substantial factor, is that significant in some way, either legally or scientifically?
That's part of the California law, part of the standard for determining causation. Did something cause something else to happen? And so part of the definition is, in deciding this, that it was a substantial factor. So they don't have to decide whether it was the only factor, whether or not there was some other element that played a role, but they had to determine that it was a substantial factor. And in fact, that it does, it can cause cancer. So that is a very big question, a very big answer, because, of course, Monsanto and their new owner, Bayer, maintain and have maintained for 40 years that there's no way that this product causes cancer. And now we have a second jury that's looked at the scientific evidence and said, well, yeah, the science says that it does.
You reported on Forthright Radio earlier in the state, the California state trial with plaintiff Dwayne Johnson. Briefly remind our listeners about that. And mind you, that was a state trial, and we're talking about the verdict yesterday was a federal trial. But please remind our listeners about Dwayne Johnson.
Right. That was the first. Dwayne Lee Johnson, he goes by Lee, is a California groundskeeper. He worked for a school district, and he sprayed Roundup on a regular basis and Ranger Pro, other Monsanto products. And he developed non-Hodgkin lymphoma, and he actually is dying. He's in very bad shape, just finished another round of chemotherapy. But the jury looked at, his case was not bifurcated, and the jury got a lot more evidence in that case than they have so far in this one. But they determined that, yes, indeed, again, Roundup and Ranger Pro caused this man's cancer, and that Monsanto was engaged in malicious conduct and was liable for huge damages because they tried so hard to hide the evidence of the dangers. They worked to influence regulators, manipulate the scientific record. They engaged in ghostwriting. The jury was particularly outraged, and they came back with a $289 million verdict against Monsanto. The judge lowered that verdict to $78 million, and Monsanto is still appealing that. It's in the California appellate court right now.
Lee was a much younger man. I think he was, what, 49?
Yeah. I mean, when he first started spraying, he was in his 40s. He's 47 now. He just had a birthday in January. He's 47 now. The plaintiff in the current case, Edwin Hardiman, is 70 years old. So, yes, he's an older man. And he was a residential user, which is different. He didn't spray it every day as part of his job on multiple properties like the first plaintiff did. And he also suffered from hepatitis C, and this was something that Monsanto made a lot of noise about with the jury, that perhaps his cancer was due to a previous condition in which he had hepatitis C. The plaintiffs argued that he was cured of hepatitis C well before he was ever diagnosed with non-Hodgkin lymphoma, and that it was the Roundup that caused it. So that was a lot of the first phase of the trial. The second phase begins today with opening statements. And this is all about damages right now. They've already found the Roundup caused the cancer. Now the discussion is, should Monsanto pay for that?
My understanding in the original bifurcation was that in the second part, the attorneys could discuss the manipulation that you were just mentioning of Monsanto. Am I incorrect about that?
No, you're correct. And all of that goes to damages. If Monsanto acted negligently, was willfully negligent, if Monsanto acted with malice in trying to cover up information about the harm of its products, all of that will play into whether or not the jury finds that Monsanto should be punished, should pay for this. Monsanto, of course, is arguing, number one, that the jury is wrong and that it doesn't cause cancer, and number two, that they have not acted badly, that they have not engaged in ghostwriting, that they have not unduly tried to influence regulators, and that all of this information and evidence that's come out is just being misunderstood and being taken out of context. So that's what the jury will hear. Now, the judge in the second phase is still really limiting the evidence, you know, quite a bit. He's not letting the jury hear about Monsanto's conduct post-2012, after Mr. Hardeman stopped using Roundup. So a lot of things that we know that Monsanto's done, because we have the internal documents, a lot of things we know that they've done to harass scientists and hide information and ghostwrite papers, a lot of that has come out since 2012. So the jury won't hear any of that in the second phase. But there are still things that they will hear that happened before 2012. So it's a little bit complicated. It's a lot for the jury to digest. And we don't know how long it'll take them. This could go for just a few more days or a few more weeks. We don't know.
Do you anticipate that Monsanto will appeal this? Is that even a possibility for them?
Oh, of course, right. Monsanto, obviously, you know, as I said, did appeal the first trial. They appealed the Johnson trial. It's in appeal right now. I assume that if they lose this and they are called upon to pay damages, that they will appeal that as well. There's another trial starting next week in Oakland, California. Monsanto said they plan to fight these pretty vigorously. Now, in this case, the federal judge, Judge Vince Chabria, has indicated that if Monsanto loses both this one and the next one, and they've already lost, of course, the Johnson case, that he would try to push for a settlement. He would try to push Bayer to come to the table with a settlement rather than continue to try hundreds and thousands of cases over and over and over.
Yes, I've heard in one of the articles you've written that there are more than 9,000 lawsuits in the U.S. now, and it sounds like there's more every day.
Yes, Bayer has actually just updated that number and said that there are over 11,000 plaintiffs now suing them.
Very briefly, you did an article in The Guardian on February 14th headlined, "Weed Killer Raises Risk of Non-Hodgkin Lymphoma by 41%. Could you very briefly describe for our listeners that meta-analysis that you reported on?
Yeah, sure. I mean, that was a very powerful new study that the plaintiffs actually used and showed to the jury in this first phase. This came out, as you said, in February. It was written by scientists who actually are so expert in their line of work that the Environmental Protection Agency had brought them in and had them sit as scientific advisors to the EPA on its review of glyphosate. And so they did a meta-analysis, which is essentially taking large studies that have already been done and putting the information together to get an overall sort of risk or understanding, an overall understanding of the risk when you put all of this information together. And they came out and said, yes, again. Again, this is a very compelling case showing causation between Roundup or other glyphosate herbicides and non-Hodgkin lymphoma in particular. And the number that they came up with was around a 41% increased risk, though they caution that trying to put a specific number on something like that is very difficult. But the evidence is quite strong that Roundup and glyphosate herbicides do cause non-Hodgkin lymphoma. It was a particularly interesting and important paper because these scientists, they're not people who work for any activist group or anything. These are academics who are considered so independent and authoritative that they were invited by the EPA to be advisors. It was also published in a journal, this is noteworthy, whose editor works for the EPA right now, is a senior scientist at the EPA. These people are trying to say, wake up, EPA, there's a problem here. And in fact, I quoted one of the scientists in my story saying that very same thing. The EPA is wrong to say that glyphosate doesn't cause cancer. These people say there's just far too much evidence for the EPA to continue to ignore that.
Kara Gillam, we thank you so much for joining us again. Your book, Whitewash, The Story of a Weed Killer, Cancer, and the Corruption of Science, has done so much to inform the greater public of this issue and others. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Our first guest today on Forthright Radio was Michael Kaufman. We spoke about his work and his latest book, The Time Has Come, Why Men Must Join the Gender Equality Revolution, published by Counterpoint Press. The views and opinions expressed on Forthright Radio are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of this station's staff, its members, board of directors, or contributors. Forthright Radio is a Beyond the Deep End production. Special thanks to our stalwart engineer, Rich Culbertson, for his extraordinary work getting that Carrie Gillum interview recorded on the fly. I'm Joy LeClaire, and you can hear past Forthright Radio programs by going to our website, forthright.media.